Okay, so today we're going to talk about dash and directory-based cache coherence. So we saw the paper which talked about how to make cache coherence more scalable, at least that was their plan. So any questions, comments about the paper before we start? Things people were confused by? People really want to answer? Apparently not. And before we go on to talking about cache coherence, any questions about homework 2 that we should spend some time on? Everyone find where they are in homework 2, at least enough to not have a question. Okay. So what the dash system did is it made it so you didn't have to broadcast all the time to cache coherence. And the way they did that is by remembering a little bit of information in something which looks remarkably like our old cache coherency diagrams. But this is in addition to the processors having the state for their cache lines. Within each cluster of processors, in their case, 4 processors, there was a directory. And the directory had an additional piece of state for every cache line, but not just every cache line that was cached, but every cache line in its memory that was, could possibly ever be cached. And this was the state machine that they had, that you had indicators in the directory about whether other nodes in the system had a copy of that piece of memory, and if so, whether it was dirty or not. And just like our normal cache coherency protocols, this directory-based scheme still has the policy that if you want to be able to write to a piece of memory, you need to be the only one with it in your cache. So if you want to be able to write to a piece of memory that's not local to you, you need to make the directory containing that memory think it's dirty and that you have it. So there's also some other information in the directory besides the state, which is that for every single piece of memory, they wanted to know if it wasn't in the uncached state, who had it. And that's because we didn't want to broadcast invalidations when someone wanted to write to it. When we either needed to send it to the dirty state or someone in our current cluster wanted to write to it. And we need to evict it from all the other nodes that might otherwise read the wrong value. And that meant that we had this list of nodes and we sent messages to only the ones who had potentially had a copy. And a subtlety that's maybe not so clear is that it's not actually guaranteed that if the directory thinks someone has a copy that they still do. They could drop their copy if it's not dirty. And they don't have to tell anyone. And that's okay because if the directory tries to tell them to invalidate the cache line, they're just going to do nothing and successfully not have any more copies of it, just like they started with. So what did people think about the overhead of this directory? So what we're storing here is 2 bits to store these 3 states for every cache block. And we also need to know who has it. Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. The reason they introduced this was to limit the performance penalty of broadcasting to a large number of nodes. If you have a huge number of nodes, then you have to keep track of presumably a ton of memory and a ton of bits for which.
Yeah. So their system had 16 nodes, each of which has 4 processors. So it was going to be a 64 processor system. And so they had 16 bits per cache line, plus 18 bits per cache line. And I believed I looked, did I look this up? No. But I think they had 32 byte cache lines on their processors. So it was a couple percent overhead. But it's proportional to the memory you need. And one thing we might go about looking at is, like, what would happen if we wanted to make a big system? Like, not just this 16-node research prototype have this type of cache concurrency. And I'll take an example of the Cray 2-3D. This is the predecessor of the machine we read about with the HyperTorus network. And it provided the same interface of you can access remote memory locations as if they're local, unlike the 2-3D, which didn't do this. And the way they dealt with cache coherency was the same as the T3E, they just didn't cache remote memories ever. You always wanked to that remote memory, so it was slow. So if you wanted to add caching, which would presumably be faster, what would you need? And let's think about the largest scale T3D that they sold, which was 256 nodes. With 64 megabytes of memory per node. And the processors that T3D used had 32 byte cache blocks, so that's 2 million cache blocks per node. And if you want to store it in a bit vector, like this paper did, for who has the block, that's 256 bits of bit vector, which is 258 bits of state per node, per cache line per node. 256 state. Which is more space for the overhead than the actual memory of the system. So the paper recognized that this was a problem. And they proposed some things you could do that they weren't doing in the research prototype. Anyone remember what some of those were or could propose your own solutions that would be better?
They talked about like having multiple levels of directories, so that each directory wasn't quite as large. I mean, that could
be wrong. So they talked about indirection.
Yeah.
And the way the indirection worked, is that you'd only store a pointer to one of the nodes to try it, and they, in their cache, associated with their cache, would store a pointer to the next one. So you can have a linked list between the nodes of who has each block. Now this is a lot more complicated to actually update, because in this case, if someone wants to hash the block cache and wants to get rid of it, they need to tell someone to make sure that linked list gets maintained. It also makes doing the invalidations have a lot higher latency. You have to send a message to everyone on the chain to read the values on that linked list. But it saves a lot of space, because you only store one node number, which is like 8 bits per entry. So that would cut this overhead down to, you know, only like 12% or something. Well, and that's one, so pretty small. So you can limit that overhead much. The other observation you could make is that you don't need to have a directory entry for everything, because you can't actually cache have everything in your memory cached remotely. And usually we think that a small portion of things are cached anyways. So you could limit the size of the directory if you had some way of like randomly looking up values. But that seems really difficult to do in an efficient way. You know, the directory they had, you just take an address and that's the address in your directory memory. That wouldn't be the case here. But if you do both these optimizations, you can get like 80 kilobytes of overhead, if you really wanted to, probably, for the T3D. So it would be practical. So any other, terms people brought up. So yeah, we talked about how much space things need. So we have with our directory information. Now let's look at how these different types of operations happen. So let's talk about how remote reads work. What do you do to read a value that's not yours? What messages need to be sent?
Well,
So to start out, we're our CPU, which is sitting in one of these nodes. We have our cluster of nodes, which are connected by a network. Now we have a CPU sitting in here, and it's going to send a message to read some value. What's going to happen to that? So this sends this on its bus. So where does that go from there? What's the next step?
All the other CPUs.
So all these other CPUs look at it. And the first possibility is what we talked about Monday happens. That one of the CPUs owns the value and is going to respond to that. So that's the fastest case, is that the value is stored locally, even though it might live here permanently, maybe there's a copy here already. So that's case one. Local read from cache, from local cache. So the value is permanently stored in a remote place, but there might be a local cache copy of it. So what if there's no locally cached copy? Then what's going to happen?
Doesn't it need to send a message to the other node that contains the memory? Because now it needs to get it.
Yeah, so there's something needs to. So there's a component here, which was their directory board. And that board had several pieces of machinery with various names. But one of them is something which talks the directory controller, which looks at requests on the bus and forwards them to remote systems. So the directory controller here is going to look at the address of A and figure out where it actually lives. And that's just a static mapping. Like they use some bits of the address to say, oh, this is on this coordinate in the network. And so it sends a message to the reply controller that's in some other node. And it says, I want to read X. So then what needs to happen? Let's assume that what's one of the things which could happen? So there's multiple possibilities. What's any one of them? Once the reply controller learns, you need to read it. The pseudo CPU, I have the wrong component. The thing connected to the request network. It's called the pseudo CPU because it takes the place of the remote CPU on the local bus. So what is the pseudo CPU going to do? So that would be the logical thing. It's not actually how their system works. Because it turns out the directory is here, and the pseudo CPU is here. So they can only communicate via the bus. So if you pause a lookup in the directory, the pseudo CPU is going to send a message on the bus saying, I want to read it. So it's going to act as a replacement for the remote CPU. And this is the way they bootstrap their protocol on top of a normal snooping cache recurrency protocol. So systems which are designed with this, with directory-based cache recurrence from the beginning probably aren't going to do this. But they need it to be compatible, and the easiest thing to do is just have the pseudo CPU just be a stand-in for those remote CPUs. So it just sends the exact same request we started out with, just on a different. So that pseudo CPU says, I want to read A. And then there's multiple possibilities. What's one of them?
Well, A could be not cached by any other node, so you just check that and pull it back.
Yeah, so one possibility is that we get it from the memory. It's remote read from remote memory. Memory, there's nothing else to do. So what's another possibility? So one pot, so that your remote read from memory was no one here has it cached. So let's say A is cached here. What could that mean?
The read request will be forwarded.
So it might mean we have to forward a read request. So it depends. So we have three possible states in total, and two of them are possible if A is cached there. So we could be in the shared state. And that means, yeah, there's another cached copy of A. And yes, I even know where it could be. But it's the same as the one I have in memory. And their choice was not to try to do anything funny where they send a message here to get the cache value, even though you could do that. They just read it from memory in that case. The other possibility is that it's dirty. So in the case where it's dirty, we need to forward the read again to what they call the owner. So in this case, so this is the home because it's where the memory that holds the value is. And this might be the owner because it's where the current version of the value is, the one who's allowed to modify it. So if this guy's the owner, then the directory controller here will look at the thing on the cache line and say, oh, that's owned by someone else. I need to pretend to be a cache which has that value on the local bus. So it's going to reply on the local bus saying, oh, no, I got this. You don't want to get this from memory. And it's going to send a request, forward the request to the owner. And what the owner is going to do is it's going to write back the value. And I believe a thing they also did is they had it send the value directly back in addition. Yeah.
Did they guarantee that the directory controller will pick up on the read request before other CPUs in the cluster? So if it's cached in the home cluster by some CPU and it's in the shared state, will one of the CPUs forward it before the directory controller?
I don't think they guarantee that. But yeah, I think in the case where it's already cached, you might have a remote read. There's another possibility, which is a remote read from a local, from remote cache. In the home system. So they could have tried to find other caches with the value by other than in the home node, but they don't do that. So that's our remote read case. That's just reading a value. We have a whole bunch of possibilities, and potentially the value has to go through three messages. So, for three messages. So one from where we're requesting it to the home where the directory entry is stored. One from the directory entry to the owner where a currently recently modified value or potentially modified value is stored. And one from the owner back to our directory node. And in addition, we might have to send an additional message to write back a changed value. So that's just our read case. So how about writes? What's different about writes? So if we want to write a value, our policy is that we have to get be the only one with the copy. So what's involved if this reader wanted to be the only one with a copy of it? Yeah.
So we'll have to find any other owners that currently had the value and then somehow tell them.
Yes. So it has to somehow send a message to every other person who has a value, whether they own it or not, and tell them, get rid of your value. Send an invalidation message. And on a bus, this is fairly easy. We just broadcast the address on the bus. But we don't like to broadcast it. So the way we're going to do that is we're going to take advantage of that bit mask we're storing in the directory, that list of who has it. Which means to do this read for ownership operation, we're going to need to send a message to the directory. So our first step, as before, is going to be that we send a message to the pseudo CPU, sends a message to the directory controller, which says, I want to take exclusive ownership of this. I want to invalidate everyone's copy. And that's going to get forwarded in the natural way where some processor will say, get exclusive access to A. Forwarded to message to get exclusive access to A. They call this a read exclusive operation. We all previously used the name read for ownership. We're all the same thing. And the pseudo CPU will send a message first invalidating all copies in the home node that may be cached. And that invalidation will be forwarded by the directory controller in the home node to everyone who might have a copy. And this means that this can send potentially messages to everyone if everyone has a copy of it. So it sends a whole bunch of invalidate messages. And eventually it gets a reply saying, I actually invalidate this packet. So in the case where that's shared, that's all we need to do. In the case where it's dirty, we need to wait for whoever has the exclusive copy, who we're going to tell to invalidate it, to write back the value. So that's our read for ownership, which is the same as things we do for writes. To write, we just get ownership, read to get ownership first, and then do our completely local read. Because once we have an exclusive local copy, we don't need to tell anyone if we change it. And the general flow as far as what the if you think of the directory and the pseudo CPU as one entity, which makes a lot more sense, is that anytime you leave this dirty state, we need to get the value written back from a remote node. We need to force that to happen. And anytime we want to enter this dirty state, we need to get rid of any other spare copies that might be lying around anywhere. So those were our, that's the basic protocol, yeah.
Real quick, when you're making those writes and you're invalidating those caches, are you actually invalidating them, or are you just giving them the value you were writing?
For which case? So when we're doing a read for ownership?
Yes, read for ownership, where we kind of tell them that they know.
You have to invalidate them.
Okay, so we can't give them a value, we can just update them with the value you want.
Yes, so in this protocol, there's not a give them a value operation. So there are other protocols you could design that I think exist. I'm not sure, there's not that much on what people actually implement for distributed greens and protocols. But you could make a protocol where you update values instead. They just didn't choose to do that. They just invalidated it first. Now you can conceptually, when you do the read for ownership, you could get an update from whoever had ownership before. That might happen. So you would have that direct transfer. It might go to you and also memory. But they don't do anything where you do a write in one step. You always get ownership first. And there'd be some real subtle issues if you tried to do it the other way. So an issue you kind of come against is, let's say our way of writing was just that you sent a message with the new value. So in that case, you might imagine that our writer, we have two writers, let's say, one and two, and we have the home node, and we have some victim here. And something which might happen is that writer one says, says I'm going to update this to a equals one, and writer two says a equals two, and you might have that happen. You might have some other person who has a copy of it cached. See those writes in a different order. And this scheme avoids that problem. But this is a really bad hit thing because here, the home node thinks it's two forever. And this victim here thinks it's one forever. And this is sort of the minimal property we want cache coherency to give us. So you could avoid this problem and still do updates, but because of this, it's not trivial to save actual work and do updates. So you need to do something where you somehow make sure that this sort of reordering doesn't happen, even if perhaps this might be a case where you got a message directly from one of the writers or something like that. And took a shortcut. But you can do. So other questions? So what do people think about the validation in this paper? Think it was good enough?
It's kind of done. They pretty much did nothing. I mean, kind of did a particle simulation.
Mm-hmm.
It was mostly, I think, it was in the category of papers written before the thing was made, so they just needed to get it out there.
Okay, so the validation was they made a bunch of test cases, and they made a random test case generator. Does that seem like sufficient, or does that seem like what you would recommend someone do if they have this sort of system?
Like, this is definitely something you can
So what would that look like, proving something about this, instead of just testing possibilities?
So you would define, you would make definitions about how these operations change the state,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to prove after an arbitrary, you have definitions of how states change,
yeah.
and then you have properties of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Make prepositions, and you would have to prove that properties hold after an arbitrary sequence of
results. So the four would be, you would write down a whole bunch of invariants.
Yeah.
They might be pretty complicated because they need to handle, we're still waiting for a message, and that sort of thing. And then we try to say that every possible message doesn't change that. And this is what people later on have done. So do you think that it's a big deal that they didn't do this? Do you think it's likely to be buggy?
Sure.
Why?
Well, I mean, you're writing random test cases. You don't know if you have completely covered.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're generating an insane amount of bugs. I'm sure.
I think if the bugs were,
also, is it possible to generate a subset of programs that demonstrates every behavior of caching stuff? I guess maybe.
So you're concerned that you might not have full coverage. And in particular, so a reason thing I would think about is that this paper talked about a number of weird things that could happen. Anyone remember what some of those weird things were?
Deadlocks.
So who here knows what a deadlock is? Some people apparently don't. So we'll talk about what a deadlock is with an example from this system. So an example reason the system can have deadlocks is that there's buffers of pending requests to me. So for example, when you're doing an invalidation as a home node, you have a buffer, and that might be full. We're going to do the simplest version, which can't actually happen in this system because of a validation. But let's assume we had a buffer of pending requests for everything. So what might happen is we send a whole bunch of reads, and we're waiting for an answer to the read, and we're reads, and that's our last request. That's the last thing we can fill in our buffer. So if we write a new request, we're just going to say no. So everyone sends a read, and everyone who receives a read is full. So they reply back to the read saying, sorry, I'm busy, try again later. And then everyone retries the read. And there's no reason, even if they're finishing a request, they could finish after they send the busy, and they could get a new one right afterwards. So there's actually no guarantee that these reads will ever complete in the face of any other work. And potentially, in the worst case, we might have all the requests in our system are things where we end up waiting on someone else who's going to get another request from someone who's waiting on someone else. Retried. And you can end up in a state where everyone has their whole buffers full and is spending all their time sending requests that are getting rejected. And they have a whole list of requests, that's all the requests they can hold, full of those requests. So the system avoids this exact case because they have separate networks for requests and replies. And what that means is that generating reply messages can't use up resources that are used to hold requests that are pending. So the space you need to know what request you might need to retry, it doesn't coincide with the space you need to reply. But this doesn't mean that they don't have a problem. So their mitigation is that these are separate. So at the least, if you want this buffer or this buffer to be full and something to be doing it, it needs to come from the same place. But they still have a problem. And that's because things like write back requests or invalidates are things that where requests generate new requests. So you can be processing a read request by generating a new request, and you could be full as far as the request you have handled. You can handle. And never be able to answer things. False for these things are ready for replies, and they can't send the reply message. They're out of space. And here we're waiting forever, just asking them, oh, please write this value back. Sorry, I'm full. I'm waiting for a bunch of reads from someone who's not giving them to me. And you can end up with this sort of problem. So deadlock is this case where we have some circular dependency, where A is waiting for B, which is waiting for A. And C is waiting for B, which is waiting for C. And this circular dependency means that everyone's waiting for each other, and no one makes any progress. And this comes because there's some shared resource. In this case, it's the space that A and C have to generate replies and to keep track of active requests. They somehow ran out of space as far as handling active requests. And the only way they can make more space is by abandoning one of their requests. So what was the paper's solution to this problem?
Can they just have a timer that after a certain number of
Yeah, so they keep retrying, but eventually they give up. And when they give up, they assume that a deadlock happened. So what they do is they take all these messages, which where they might need to generate new requests in response to a request, and they just reject them outright for a while, until it seems like they aren't getting packets anymore. So after a while, they give up on this, they return back to this read which required writebacks. They say, sorry, can't do that right now. And hopefully free up space for someone to make progress. The hope is by giving people less work that someone will eventually make progress and you won't have a loop where everyone is requesting resources and then saying, no, can't do that. And by the time that they retry, those resources have been requested again, so they're still busy. The hope is to free up some resources so you get rid of the deadlock. And they're paying primary attention to things where requests generate requests. And the worst case in this system is invalidations. Because when you need to invalidate something, you might need to send a whole lot of messages. So you can have this big explosion of dependencies. That's probably the easiest way to generate a deadlock. So deadlocks are a general concept that usually people talk about in threaded programming, but they also, as we see, come up in hardware. So a particular challenge with things like deadlock is for validation. So their testing strategy did not generate very large programs. So I am skeptical. I don't know, you might have a different opinion. I don't know what a good way of proving either way. I'm skeptical that their testing strategy would commonly generate deadlock situations. And clearly there's some complicated logic about where you behave differently during a deadlock. And it'd be sure nice to know whether that makes the system not work. So also there's another validation question where if you just use the validation strategy you described, does that handle deadlock?
If it's encoded in your invariants.
Yeah, yes. So your invariants need to somehow include, are we deadlocked now? And that's not just, are we getting the right answers, but are we getting answers? That's part of the properties you need to prove. So it's not just a matter of proving that you'll never hear a wrong value, you also need to prove that you'll eventually hear a value, because the system admits situations where you won't unless some measures are taken. You can actually end up with situations where the protocol is correct in the sense that you won't get the wrong answer, but incorrect in the sense that you might never complete your memory access, which is almost as bad. So they also talked about a couple other weird situations. Anyone remember any of them? So we had a deadlock where we have some full buffers, and we're waiting on people to have more space to store things in buffers in order to release space in our buffers that they're waiting on us to release. But they also had some situations which conceptually didn't involve full resources that had the same problem where you might not have progress. They had the one particular thing they were worried about. Well, let's look in more detail at how the writes work in the system to remind everyone. Yeah, so let's say someone has a copy of a value. And some owning system has a copy of a value, and I want to get an exclusive copy of it. So this is the message flow. So their own CPU sends a message to their directory over their bus that I want to own this value. It's forwarded to the home directory. The home directory looks up Sentry and says, oh, it's dirty. So I need to send this message elsewhere, but who owns it? Okay, it's this guy. So I'm going to tell him, I want to transfer ownership to this remote directory for this value. And the owning directory will invalidate the value, then transfer what was written back. tell the transfer what it's written back and say, oh yeah, you got it, you're set. And then there's an acknowledgement message. And it doesn't seem like this acknowledgement message is necessary. It seems like it's enough for this owning directory to say, I just gave it up and I told the real directory that it doesn't, that I don't have this value anymore, I gave it to you. And they have this optimization where usually they didn't like forward this message through the home directory. So anyone remember, like, so there's a subtle issue which was related to this optimization. So because the home directory doesn't tell the remote system that they're the new owner, transferred from someone else, there's something which can happen which is a bit weird. Or maybe not because of that, but very related to that.
They say something about a cluster receiving multiple acts or acknowledgments.
Mm-hmm.
If the ownership is bouncing back and forth.
Yeah, so possible NACs. So NAC is a negative acknowledgement.
Oh, yeah.
Which is probably a really poor name, but so in between the time when, so these two messages here, I'm showing them as separate after each other. But that's not really what might happen. Instead, they're sent over a network which has uneven length paths. They're probably going to take different amounts of time to get there. So it could be the case that this remote directory learns that it has ownership of the block before the home directory does. And that means if in that meantime, the home directory receives the value, here I have the example. So let's say, you know, someone wants to read this value, 3x to read the value. And in the meantime, after the home directory forwards that read, and before it actually gets processed, it gets transferred. In that case, the read fails. The read fails because this remote node already promised to send this to someone else, can't take that back. So it doesn't know what the value is anymore once it gives it away. And even though the home directory doesn't know about that, by the time it forwards it, or even by the time it forwards it, you know, it's just going to get back a message saying, sorry, that read that you forwarded me is not mine. And the read's going to fail. It might send it directly to remote 3. I don't remember exactly which. But the read's going to fail because this remote 1 is going to get it and it's no longer going to be the owner. And you can have the ownership flipping back and forth here indefinitely. So it could be that this next read is also going to fail because the ownership will change. Like this guy, the remote 2 could give up ownership right here. So the read could fail every single time. And if it fails every single time, so if you keep switching ownership back and forth, and this read keeps trying and can't work yet because we didn't figure out who the owner was, we're going to have a situation that's called live lock. It's sort of kind of the opposite of deadlock. So instead of everyone waiting on each other, no one's waiting. Everyone's trying to do stuff. But someone is never actually catching up. And this remote 3 is never actually reading from the real owner, so never actually makes progress, even though it's trying all the time to do that. And as I recall, they didn't really have a solution to this problem. You just hoped that eventually you figure it out. But you could probably construct a case where the delays were such that it would happen consistently if people were sharing a value, such that they were, one would write it and then the other would write it. So another thing that the paper talked about, which is very important and we'll talk about next time, was memory consistency. So anyone have a summary of what they said about memory consistency or some high-level surprising point?
They talked about eventual consistency.
So they talked about, yeah, something like eventual consistency. So eventual consistency is a concept from databases. And as a certain flavor of database person, I would say it's another word for no consistency. They weren't quite so bad here, but they have something called release consistency. And release consistency basically means that we guarantee locks will probably work right. And that's it. So, so there's a release operation, and it guarantees that everything before the release operation actually finishes. And in most definitions of release consistency, there's also an acquire operation. And the idea is that everything between an acquire and a release are guaranteed to happen after the release, and you don't finish an acquire. When you do an acquire, you're guaranteed to see all of what was released or not. So you get the thing where if you do something in a critical section, you see the state of what last happened in the critical section, as long as you begin the critical section with an acquire and end it with a release. So you can think of the release operation as a releasing a lock, and the acquire operation as acquiring a lock. And the idea is that this makes those locks behave correctly, and if you do anything else, pretty much all bets are off. So if you do pretty much anything else, you can actually see any order pretty. That's what the guarantees they're making say, literally you can receive any order, with the exception that your reads and your writes from your thread will occur in order. Free. That's the only guarantee they have. Other people's reads and writes, any order, even if it doesn't make sense. So, for example, let's say we start with A and B equals 1. It is possible that you could read 2 for B from somewhere, and then you could read 1 for A. Even though this program writes them the other order. And that's something they allow in their system because there's no acquire or release operation here. So why was this useful for them to do? What were they gaining by letting us have this illogical result of seeing B written before A?
Home directories don't need to coordinate when they write into memory.
Right? Okay.
So if there's multiple home directories servicing write requests, there's no mechanism required for them to synchronize.
Yeah, so one possibility is that A and B are stored in different nodes. And in that case, we don't require them to make sure that the write to A2 completes. Write to A completes before the write to B because they're different nodes, which would require sending extra messages or doing some extra coordination. So you can end up with a case where you have, because of that, you have out of order writes. So let's say A is owned by node 1 and B is not. That's a simple case where they're in different places. So A gets written right away. And B needs to go to the home for B, which causes eventually changes the value, but requires some invalidations to happen first. And those might take a while. So in the meanwhile, we might read B as 1 from the cache while that's happening. So that's a simple case where, because we because this set operation takes a while, that we could read the wrong values. And it's just because we're letting a value be cached while write is pending, and not guaranteeing strictly that the writes actually occur in the right order. I suppose I meant this to be B equals 2. Yes, I probably did. So the other thing which can happen, besides the values being written in the wrong order, so the values can be written in the wrong order from them being in different places is the easiest way. They can also be read in the wrong order. In that we can send two read requests and they can be received at different times, even though the write request happened in the right order. And you can get the values back in the right order even, because the network could take arbitrary amounts of time. But you could read them in the wrong order as a result of reading them remotely and not coordinating when each of those reads happen. And I'd like to apologize because I clearly messed up this example. Probably need to swap A and B or something. But the idea is that they're just in different places and you might read a cache value while you're waiting for an invalidation to actually finish a write. So what is the solution to this problem? If we didn't want to have this release consistency problem, what would we need to do to fix it?
You have to have some knowledge of all pending reads and writes that you can tap into.
Maybe like a clock of some sort. Okay.
So there's a simpler solution. So the simple solution is the problem up here is occurring because we let this read continue to happen while another read is allowed to happen. We probably just shouldn't do that. And the same thing is true for writes. We keep doing work while we are waiting for invalidations to happen for a write. We shouldn't do that. So a way to get more normal consistency would be for node 1 and node 2 to not just let this operation happen whenever it would happen. And this writes happen out of order here. But to wait for home B to say, oh, I'm done, and home A to say, yes, I'm done, before proceed. So is that bad, very bad, okay for performance?
Pretty bad.
Pretty bad? Why?
Well, essentially you're enforcing like atomic memory operations, and that's not good in general.
So yeah, so it's pretty bad for performance because we need to wait for an extra round to run the network. So we're probably making things roughly twice as slow. And it could be worse because we could be actually waiting for a whole bunch of cache operations on a contending bus. So that's not good for performance. And that's the big thing they're gaining by using release consistency. In exchange for letting you get these illogical results, which don't seem to make sense, like here, where reads just happen in the wrong order, you're getting faster writes and reads because you don't bother waiting for an acknowledgement for each one. You can actually do multiple in parallel. And this is something we see as a common theme in these distributed memory systems, that we need a way to do multiple, to hide the latency of these remote reads. And this is the system's way, is that it lets them happen in a different order, so it's a lot of flexibility to have lots of them in flight. And it gets away with this without having problems about what values are written in what order by just letting them be written in a different order. So an alternative would be the sorts of things you're proposing where you come up with some way of figuring out what a consistent order was. And that's much harder. And I don't know anyone who does that outside of databases. And that's going to be the topic for next time, by the way. So next time we have a paper on shared memory consistency models. So release consistency is a memory model. And this paper is going to be about them in general. And it's a tutorial, so I think it's fairly readable. And for a more modern perspective, I'd also like to read just the first section of a paper on the memory model that the C++ programming language requires compilers to emulate. To find out what that is, since things were less certain at the time this paper was written. And I think there's probably a general idea that these lesson hardware consistency models aren't so great, based on what happens with what has happened with the C++ memory model. They push back a lot of hardware manufacturers for implementing not so great consistency models. But, I mean, the attraction of release consistency is that always lock is usually the advice you have for doing programming. Doing concurrent programming, at least the first advice. Like, people tell you that you shouldn't expect good results if you don't lock. So this just makes the hardware implement that discipline and nothing else.
So I'm curious, how useful is the memory consistency guarantee if stuff is running in parallel, like on a cluster anyway? Like, how is it useful to the programmer to know that,
depending
on who starts executing this first, that will actually happen in order?
So there are things that people try to do in real code, so there's two issues. So one is implementing locks. So the consistency model affects what you have to do to implement locks. And that's a big issue. And also affects what you can safely do as far as compilers, in the sense that you can't make anything, shouldn't make things work. You need to make sure that things don't happen in a too illogical order. And release consistency allows a lot more illogical things than what I showed, conceptually. You can have a case, release consistency allows you to, technically, as specified, I don't think it's possible in the dash system, but the most general case of release consistency allows you to do something like A equals 3, and then A, and read X equals 1, Y equals 3. Which is very confusing. And you would not expect to ever happen, especially if you're actually the only thread modifying A. So usually they don't allow that pattern, but there are similar, really weird things. The more common case is that thread 1 writes A equals 3, and what can actually happen on some systems is that if you read A multiple times, you can get X equals 3, Y equals 1, Z equals 3, even if that's the only write to A that's happening. So we'd like to prohibit some things, usually, because they're considered not great for programmers. This is not fun to reason about.
But, I guess I would always talk that, when two threads are executing something, you can't make any assumptions about
yes,
what is happening. And if you can make assumptions about what's happening, then they're not running in, I guess I just understand how useful it would be to know that, hey, these
it's a matter of what guarantees we provide the programmer, and that's a choice we have to make. But very loose models are just really hard to reason about, because this also holds true, even if you send a message through a file in between here. Because that's not a lock. And those sorts of things are really confusing to programmers. Where you know something is executing later. And the other issue is that we want to implement locking primitives. And implementing locking primitives is going to require us knowing, making sure we provide the guarantees that the lock actually does something useful. And under release consistency, if you just do read, modify, write, if you do the compare and swap we showed you to implement a lock, That's not enough. That does not implement what people think of as a lock, because everything else can be reordered over the compare and swap. As long as it's not that memory location, it could be reordered. And so this really matters when you like to implement those primitives. Also, there are some cases about where you want to do things without locks, which is, should be possible because we can get exclusive ownership of stuff. So efficient multi-thread code is going to do that. We'll talk about that a little next week. So Wednesday's papers are about implementing locks, including a paper which compares around 30 different lock implementations. Yes, there are 30 different ways of implementing locks on a symmetric multiprocessor, and sees how they affect the performance of some real programs. And obviously, to implement those locks, you need to know, are you actually providing the guarantees the locks have in what you're doing? And if you're doing things where you want it to be faster than waiting for absolutely every memory operation to finish, you actually need to know what the guarantees are. And so for like an example of a thing you could do much faster without a full lock is like if you want to implement reference counting. So in reference counting, we keep track of how many people have a copy of something. And that incrementing a value and reading it can be done much faster than waiting for every single memory operation to happen. And so if you have a system which uses reference counting and you want to optimize it to be really fast, this is something you might care about, is how do we make that, how do we get the guarantees we need for the reference counting to be correct, but I don't care about synchronizing everything else in the program. Okay, so I'll make a little diversion into what real directories do. So there are real processors that are common today which use directories. And they don't quite look like the dash directories. So I'll start with Intel. So the thing I can find documentation for is the Haswell EP. Presumably more recent ones are basically the same. So they have a directory. And you might ask, where is it stored? And it turns out that they store it in memory. So on server processors, you use ECC RAM, which has error-correcting code bits. And what they do to store their directory is they steal two of the error-correcting code bits for every cache line and use that to store the state. So that's 0.4% overhead, much, much better than the numbers we were talking about for the other scheme. But they're only storing two bits. So they're not storing that bit vector of who has the value. So what they're choosing between is it a local operation or is it a broadcast operation? They're not actually doing the optimization where they only send in validations to people who actually have it. They're just doing the optimization where they don't send it if I'm the only one who has it. So, and they store it in the ECC bits. Some papers call this free, but it's not actually free because the error-correcting code bits are used to detect bit flips in the memory from physical problems. And if you can't use some of those bits, that means that sometimes some bit will flip in the memory where you would have detected it before, now you won't. But it's a pretty minor cost, and they're switching from a 16-bit error correction code to a 15-bit one. So they also have a cache for directory entries. And unlike the values they store in memory, this cache actually does have that bit mask. So for recently accessed things, they store the bit mask. But for non-recently accessed things, they don't. So they got this compromise where they don't get the whole overhead of storing who has everything all the time. But they do it for commonly accessed things, things which are likely to be things that we're going to get messages over our network about. And in the case where you don't know that bit vector, you just assume everyone has a copy and broadcast. And this works reasonably well because the biggest Haswell system I know about has 8 sockets. A lot more cores, but the sockets have one L3 cache on them, and that's what the directory is for. It talks to the L3 cache. Everything else is local, just like each of the nodes here had four processors. Here the nodes are one socket, one chip. And to give you another example, so the IBM Power 6 is another system with a directory, and they use a very similar thing. They store one bit for each cache line in memory, again in the ECC bits. So there's some loss of reliability. That's where they store it. So what one bit would you want to store? So the cache protocol has three states, that means two bits. How would you reduce that to one bit?
Because you are the owner or you're not the owner.
Yeah. So they store, is it uncached remote or anything else? So they take the shared remote and the dirty remote states and consolidate them into one. So all they care about is, do I need to broadcast things about this value or not? So the idea is that most accesses are local and you just want to remember that it's local. And they have no storage or the remote location anywhere. Though when things go into the cache, they do take the bit about who has it with it. So it's part of what's cached. It's actually part of their cache coherency protocol, which is a good example of how cache coherency protocols can get complicated. So these 14 things here are the states of their cache coherency protocol, just as an aside. Because they want to do that. And in addition, this encodes the information about whether it's remote or not, in addition to whether it's modified, owned, exclusive, shared, and whether you should forward the value or not. That's why they get so many states, that they have all those possibilities. And some other weird things, like they have invalid lines, which are in the cache, but marked as things you shouldn't allocate into entries for. I'm not sure exactly what that's for, but it's in their table. So people really do this, but you know, typically not at these, you know, the sort of scale of like the T3D. Because these techniques don't actually seem to scale that high. And the real ones, they're fine doing broadcast. The assumption is that if you want more than that, you're going to use separate memory spaces. So I'd like to mention another possibility for implementing this sort of shared memory that we're not going to talk about exactly how you do, but I'd like you to be aware that it's there. And that's, you can do it in software. So we can just do this with page tables and the operating system. So you implement some MSI-like protocol in software. But instead of working on cache blocks, you work on pages. And for writes, to handle writes correctly, you have the operating system make pages read-only so it knows when writes happen. So if a page is in the shared state, you make the page read-only, and you wait for a write to happen, and when that happens, the TLB entry will be looked up and it will say, this page has this physical address, but it's read-only, you can't write to it, and that will trigger an exception. The operating system will get run and it can execute basically the cache coherency protocol, but in software. And for reads, you just remove an entry from the page table and you get a page fault saying, oh, it's not there. And the OS can look up, oh, I know why it's not there. It's because I don't have a copy of this page yet. I need to bring it in from a remote node. This is really an OS topic, but I'd like you to be aware that this is an option that people have used to implement this at a larger scale. And in software, you have more choices about how you can manage the state. Like, you can easily keep a very large directory with a very complicated structure in software. So we're almost done. And before I finish, so we did like a pretty broad overview of things we do in cache coherency. And next time we'll be moving on to a related but different topic of what the memory model we provide to programmers. And that's going to be from problems in cache coherency like we saw here, where sometimes we send two reads to two different places and they don't happen in order. But we're also going to have problems that happen in the chip. Like in the R10000, remember, they did multiple loads at the same time. They tried very hard to make sure that they happened in program order. But not all chips are going to do that. And that's another source of reordering we're going to have. And the paper next week is going to deal with all of those. But another thing people do in cache coherency that's sort of a more recent extension, I don't know that it's really been implemented, is that you might imagine trying to identify access patterns and changing what your coherence policy is. So for example, let's say you detect that processors are reading a value and then writing it most of the time. You'd really like to cache those in a way where you just assume that first read it should get exclusive ownership. So you can make a coherency protocol where you have some extra states, and one of those states is this value is, you know, shared, but usually is read, or but usually is read to be written immediately. And you can treat that state differently and treat reads of that value as a get exclusive ownership and cause invalidations. And you can implement other optimizations of this sort. And this is a direction that people have been looking in research at taking cache coherency protocols, among other things. Another big research topic is how do you actually make it easy to write cache coherency protocols and know they're correct? So as the DAT system shows us, when you have to worry about messages being sent from place to place and these error conditions, it gets very complicated to figure out, prove that your protocol is correct. Okay. And before I go, so next Monday, I'm hoping to have a consultant from our teaching center to do a focus group after the class to hopefully find out how I can teach this class better and teach better in the future. You don't have to be here, but I appreciate it if you would be, so I could get some hopefully useful feedback that I can apply. And that means we'll cut class off a little short. And so as I said, papers for next time are, so this tutorial on shared memory models, and just a brief read to learn about when someone was choosing for a programming language, what interface they want to give a programmer, what did they choose for C++, and what were their concerns they had, which is just section one. Please don't read the whole thing. It's like dense programming language proof stuff. Well, not really dense, but not stuff I expect you to actually understand afterwards. And that's all I have, so I'll take questions about the homework, or if anyone has other lingering questions about what we talked about today. No? Okay.